The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
I don't think they can get an acquittal. I don't think they're going to get 12 votes unanimously to acquit him. I think their best shot, and that's what they're going to do, is hope that there's just some person on the jury who just refuses to convict. But again, I think that's going to be really, really hard with Trump having signed 8 of those checks and also the attempts to so much other evidence, but the attempts to basically conceal it all. I'm not sure how a good outcome, other than possibly the luck of the draw, mistrial on a hung jury, 11-1 or 10-2. I don't see a good outcome for Donald Trump out of this.
My perspective here is I do think that he gets convicted, probably. I don't think that matters politically. I think the crazy MAGA right that supports him always will support him.
Man, I do worry that there are lawyers on this jury, not one, but two lawyers. And by my own experience, lawyers can sometimes be overly analytical. They can be hyper technical. And I do worry that the non-lawyers on this jury may rely on the lawyers who, quite frankly, don't have expertise in this area of the law.
And this case is not a slam dunk, which means that Donald Trump may very well not be convicted. Acquitted is the worst case scenario for Democrats, because then it's the only trial you have, and Donald Trump gets to go out there and say, Joe Biden's prosecutors, which again, not true, came after me. His Department of Justice came after me, and they still didn't convict me. I'm still innocent. I also think you could end up somewhere in this sort of muddy middle where you end up with a hung jury, a jury that cannot reach a verdict, and then this truly does just get kicked to the voters to decide.
It is unheard of to get to a point where only at the time of the charging conference is there clarification as to the government's theory for making felonies out of misdemeanors. I mean, this is bizarre, and I've been around the law and criminal justice for 35 years. Can't think of a trial that had this much mystery to what the government was trying to do to avoid.
And very important, we saw in the arguments last week that the judge was basically saying in our jury instructions, I'm going to be leaning towards saying that the jury does not have to agree on what the second crime is. There are three theories of the case. Not all 12 jurors have to agree on each theory. They just have to think that one of those three theories occurred, and that's enough to convict, I think.
And the prosecution is going to say, hey, this is common sense. We're talking about a guy, Donald Trump, who watched every penny. Do you really think that he would have been cool with all this money going out of his account without knowing it? Do you really think he would just reimburse $430,000, whatever that number is, without some knowledge about what was going on? Of course not. So it's a common sense case, and I suspect that it's going to be successful.
Right. So it's the judge's job, as Judge Mershon told the lawyers last week. He's the one who gets to tell the jury what the law that they will use in evaluating the evidence is. And you can understand why that's important. He's the one who will explain to jurors what the burden of proof means and what sort of evidence they would need to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But some of the charging here is novel. This is, I think, the first case, if not the first, it's a rare case where the business records falsification crime is charged in connection with a campaign finance violation, and the judge will have to craft some unusual jury instructions. So there will be a lot of art that goes into that and negotiation with the parties.
I have to say some version, because even though Congress created the Federal Election Commission and vested it and the Justice Department with exclusive authority to enforce the federal election laws in the United States, Bragg, who has no such authority, the district attorney in Manhattan, is really making up his own version of what campaign law is. And it appears from all of the arguments that they've made last week that that's where they're headed. But I have to say, you're asking a good question, because the indictment, I think, fails as an indictment because it doesn't put the defense on notice about what the charges are. Bragg's been cagey throughout. And to this day, we don't even have the jury charge that the judge is going to give next week, the instructions to the jury. Well, it's a cogent story. It's just not a story that violates the law. But I think, you know, to the extent that those left of center legal commentators are predicting a conviction, they may be right because of the way the case has been pitched to the jury. You know, it's one thing for us to be here pronouncing on what all of the various legal flaws are, and there's a plethora of them, but you have to try to see the case the way the jury is seeing it. And in this instance, I think the jury is seeing it through the lens of Judge Merchan, who has been very indulgent of the prosecution's dodgy theories here. And, you know, I could sit here and poke holes in them all day, but it doesn't make a difference because we're not in there speaking to the jury.
I wanted to play all of those clips for you so you'd get a little bit of each side there. And it's amazing how partisan people are on this case, how one side can see it for exactly what it is. It's ridiculous. There isn't just even the people that despise Donald Trump. Well, they'll say, what is the actual crime being committed here? Is this really the standard of justice that we want? And then you have the other side there, like some of those clips at the start that say, this is very bad for Trump. I don't see how he gets away from this. And some of them admitting, I'll just read some of those quotes here. This is the worst case scenario for Democrats. It's the only trial they have left. I mean, just outright saying this is lawfare. This isn't about upholding the rule of law anymore. This is about politics. And they say that as they're destroying the rule of law. They don't care. And they're so callous about it. They're so casual about what they're doing. It's horrifying what they're doing. And they're so far past that point that they could just view using the legal system as this way as just, it's just run-of-the-mill politics now. Still, nobody can explain what law was broken. Alvin Bragg can't explain it. The judge can't explain it. The jurors don't know what law was broken. But now it just comes down to Judge Merchan can just set the bar. He gets to define to those jurors, do you agree with this statement, yes or no? And then if those 12 jurors say yes, he's convicted. So it all comes down to the will of Judge Merchan, a highly conflicted judge who should have recused himself. It's his will now. Well, Tuesday, tomorrow, they'll wrap up. I think they get their closing remarks. Each side gets to explain their last argument, and then the jury goes into deliberation later this week. And I think that could take anywhere from, you know, just an afternoon to multiple days. So maybe we'll know by the end of this week how the jury decides. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston, your guest host for today's show. Any comments for the show, you can send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much again for joining us on this Memorial Day weekend, this three-day weekend. We'll have a bit of content for you on that towards the end of the show. I wanted to talk more about, again, just the coverage of this case from these media pundits. And this is from Conservative Treehouse about the judge. I mean, again, it comes down to how is the judge, what is he going to allow the jurors to hear? What's he going to allow them? He gets to decide, well, that evidence isn't admissible. And the jury can't make a decision based on something that they heard that isn't admissible. It's all seen through this judge's eyes, this judge whose daughter profits off of Donald Trump's demise. A judge who should have recused himself. And all of those talking heads just act like this is totally fine. This is the new campaign sphere that we're working in. We're going to use the court system. Forget ads, forget hitting the campaign trail. We're going to use the justice system. And to them, that's now just totally normal. And there's no fear that it could be turned against them. There's no fear about what they're doing to the country, about how they're tearing it apart, inciting civil war. Conservative Treehouse says, the entire world is watching what happens in New York City through the prism of ridiculous lawfare and politics. No intellectually honest observer believes this is a trial about substance, guilt, criminal activity, or innocence therein. I mean, go back and listen to what those analysts analysts as being too nice to even say it that way. The propagandists were saying about this case, I mean, just flagrantly admitting that it's political. But then you get the somewhat more honest analysts saying things like, this is a novel case. This is unheard of to get to a point here where a law hasn't even been defined. You know, what is the actual crime? Can't think of a trial that had this much mystery about what the government was trying to do. There was another one here. The judge will have to craft some unusual jury instructions. There will be a lot of art that goes into this. This is the way they function. We talk about the show. Mr. Gerald Fleury has talked about the dark arts, dark sentences, the way these people operate. It's will worship. Making up his own version of what campaign law is. That was from McCarthy. And he's the one that coined that phrase, that said Obama was trained in the dark arts of intelligence misinformation. They all have to see it through the lens of the judge. Conservative Treehouse says, finding President Trump guilty of a crime is seemingly a foregone conclusion. Even the White House is saying Joe Biden will deliver remarks to the nation from the official executive office as soon as the guilty verdict is delivered. Judge Merchant has yet to release the public version of jury instructions. However, he previously decided last week that the jurors do not need to agree on a predicate crime in order to find President Trump guilty of trying to hide one. So these are his instructions. It doesn't matter what motivated Donald Trump to commit the crime, just decide that he did it. I mean, that is being pretty vague in and of itself. And what I just said there isn't even half of it. I mean, for that little misdemeanor to be a misdemeanor, it has to be driven by a larger criminal scheme. And they won't say what that scheme is. He's basically saying it doesn't matter. You just find, did he commit this fraud? And if he did, it proves that there was another criminal scheme. Conservative Treehouse says, yes, you read that correctly. The jurors do not need to believe a crime was committed in order to convict Trump of unlawfully hiding a crime he never committed. Let that insufferable lawfare logic sink in. I mean, this is the stuff that's terrifying. You get Morning Joe screaming about Donald Trump being a fascist, being a dictator on day one. These are the dictators. This is horrifying to think of. And this is Donald Trump, the billionaire, who has the resources to fight this sort of stuff, who has the ability to be there day in and day out and not lose his job. I mean, if they do this to American citizens who don't have the means, all of those January 6th defendants. That is a show of force by this dictatorial regime currently in power to intimidate, to frighten people from speaking out. Mr. Fleury talked about last week all of the lawyers that are getting indicted. Who's going to bring the case if there's fraud in 2024? No lawyer wants to lose their license. No lawyer wants to get put in jail. And they're not billionaires like Donald Trump. They have to keep working. Miranda Devine at the New York Post. Verdict on Trump judge's bias at hush money trial is in. Guilty. And just talks about some of the things we've already mentioned about how conflicted the judge is. She writes, juries are always stuck in a sort of Stockholm syndrome relationship with their judges. So Merchant's attitude toward the witness has a profound effect on how much weight they gave to his testimony. This is talking about how the judge, he'd let Stormy Daniels come in and talk about all the most disgusting things you could ever hear. And then when Trump brings in a witness that actually has material facts relevant to the case, he's not allowed to talk. The judge interjects and decides, that's not coming into my courtroom. Wouldn't say that about Stormy Daniels. Wouldn't say that about all of the irrelevant details that she was bringing to the case. Let that play out because it's a smear campaign. So the jury just gets to view this case through the judge's eyes. Devine says, constitutional lawyer David Schoen, who defended Trump in his first impeachment, said Merchant's conduct was shocking and reprehensible. Merchant's handling of the trial has been such a disaster that any guilty verdict will almost certainly be overturned on appeal, but that will only happen after the election, which allows Biden to smear his opponent as a convicted felon, which of course is the whole point. I wanted to go back to something Mr. Gerald Flurry, Trumpet editor-in-chief, wrote about the first case against Donald Trump. This is the 2016, the Russia hoax that turned into the Mueller special counsel. And then in, I think it was 2019, Bill Barr gets appointed and he writes this memo to Mueller that basically says, you've got to back off. You have nothing here. But this precedence was set. This defines the lawfare against Donald Trump. It defines the lawfare used against all of these conservatives, really. This is the August 2019 Philadelphia Trumpet. Mr. Flurry, in an article titled, Can President Trump Get Control of His Own Divided Government? He starts by quoting this memo that Barr wrote. The crux of Mueller's position is that whenever the president exercises any of these discretionary powers and thereby influences a proceeding, he has completed the guilty act of the crime of obstruction, Barr wrote. To establish guilt, all that remains is evaluation of the president's state of mind to divine whether he acted with a corrupt motive. Mueller believes that if he can find a corrupt motive in the mind of the president, then the president is guilty of obstruction. It's exactly what Bragg is doing. We don't have to define what the crime is. I used that analogy last week, the rolling through the stop sign. Well, why did he roll through it? Well, it could be he just wasn't paying close attention. Maybe he was in a hurry. Maybe he was fleeing the scene of a crime, a murder, a bank robbery. You don't know. But it's a misdemeanor, but they divine what that motive was. And Merchant's line of reasoning is that, well, all I need is for the jury to decide that Donald Trump rolled through that stop sign. And then, because he rolled through it, that means he's clearly guilty of a bigger criminal scheme that we don't have to explain to you. Pure will worship, divining a motive. Mr. Flurry says, this is diabolical reasoning that would destroy the president's authority to enforce the law. This is not the way the law works. These men who are bringing down America are psychoanalyzing people, searching for corrupt motives. But that isn't the way the law is. It deals with clear and specific actions. These men think they can divine whether Trump acted with a corrupt motive. Mr. Flurry says, another definition of divine as an adjective is of, like, or from God or a God. That too is appropriate because these men are acting as if they are God. Do you really want to be ruled by someone who thinks he can sit there and act like God, telling you that you have a corrupt motive? Do you want these men with corrupt minds judging you? That's what's terrifying. That's the fascism. That's the despotism that Morning Joe screams about every single morning, right there in this courtroom playing out. We have the rule of law, and these people are attacking it to get Trump. And it's not just Trump. I mean, he says it a lot. I'm just standing in their way. They're trying to get to you. This is a clip from Kim Strassel. She was on just talking about how the Democrats are using this lawfare, and they won't let anything get in their way. As much as they talk about how fearful they are of fascism, they really love it. They really like using it when they're the ones in power. This is clip 5.
Our nation is really seeing a massive decline in faith in institutions, including the justice system, obviously the White House, obviously Congress, which I think has the absolute lowest rating. How critical is it that we somehow find a way to stem the use of lawfare to this extent? Are you concerned about this?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, let's also remember why we get to lawfare. We get to lawfare when one party loses elections, Democrats, as they had done, you know, back when they lost to Donald Trump in 2016. And even though it's pretty clear, as you can see from Joe Biden's polls, that the public do not like their views, instead of changing those views, they instead try to sideline or get rid of the opposition by using other means, in particular, lawfare. This is a terrible thing. because it's not just the loss of faith in institutions that people feel, but it is a terrible sort of falling apart of the parties themselves, right, which really need to be out there winning on ideas and convincing people, not just using other tools to try to kneecap the opposition.
It just shows the state that this country is in. They know that they can't win a campaign. Joe Biden isn't out there in the Bronx campaigning. So they get more and more desperate. They'll get more and more violent. And it's leading to war. I mean, this today's Memorial Day. This is about remembering the soldiers who died for this country. And look at what it's turned into. They die because we have freedom. And what maintains that freedom is the Constitution, the rule of law, that we all agree to abide by that, and one side gets in charge and they completely crush it. And the other side, frankly, just watches it happen weekly and just says, well, it's got to compromise. We've got to find the middle ground so we can get back to decency, so we can all be friends in the D.C. swamp. I mean, I'll talk about it. Mr. Fleury has more quotes about that. As this country was built because a lot of people were willing to die for those ideals. And we don't have that anymore. We don't have people who are willing to die for freedom. Not the numbers that we used to. Well, I was just going to comment a little bit, talking about campaigning and how the Democrats won't even, they don't go back to just the usual politics. They have to use the court system. Donald Trump, he's out there in the Bronx, and that really upsets Democrats. That upsets AOC. She can't get anybody to show up for her. I don't even think she's actually from that area where she runs. I think she grew up further upstate in New York. And the same with Governor Hochul, who talks about, I mean, Donald Trump isn't us. He doesn't represent us. She's not even from New York City. Donald Trump is from that city. He built large portions of that city. Donald Trump, talk about campaigning. He goes to, I think this was Saturday or Sunday, he goes to the Libertarian National Convention. I don't know a lot about libertarians, don't care that much, but they're always that party that will sneak in and they pull away 2 or 3% of the vote. And they never side with conservatives. They don't want to side with Democrats. I don't know how much the Libertarian Party is actually libertarian. I mean, you look at the person that they nominated and they're all for transgender or genital mutilation surgeries, it's pretty much everything goes, just leave me alone sort of approach. But Donald Trump somehow is able to speak at their national convention where they're going to pick a nominee. And I think the tactic here is go there to prevent RFK from becoming their nominee, go there to prevent them from voting for RFK, and maybe go there to show how crazy they actually are. Donald Trump is bold. Donald Trump goes into a place where he knows he's not going to be greeted well, and he goes to battle with them. This is an analyst just talking about what Trump could expect going in. I think she made this comment before he even visited that convention. This is clip 4.
So, Susan, I'm going to switch gears because tonight Trump is planning to speak at the Libertarian National Convention in order to thwart, that's such a hard word to say, RFK Jr.'s campaign. Is this a further indication that Trump views RFK Jr. as a real threat?
Absolutely. But it was a smart campaign maneuver, even though he will probably be greeted with boos. If he can prevent RFK Jr. from getting the Libertarian line, that will be a huge significant win for Trump and or Biden, depending on which state and which demographics you're talking about. Because the important thing about the Libertarian Party and why they're both fighting for it is it gives ballot access in nearly every state. I don't think they'll hit 50 this year. It may be 46, 48. But RFK Jr. is nowhere close to that. So I think Trump went in there, even if they don't give it to him, just not to give it to RFK Jr.
So they know they're probably going to go in there and get booed. And again, it's smart on Trump's side because you never hear about the Libertarian National Convention. I don't think most people care, except those 2 to 3%. So they're going to probably see this convention. They'll see Trump go in there. He'll get booed by the hardliners in that party. But then they're going to watch that, and then they're going to see how crazy that party has actually become and how crazy their leader is and probably go and vote for Donald Trump. And again, to Trump's credit, he's out there and he's going before a hostile audience. Listen to this clip and listen to how he throws it right back in their face. This is clip 8. I think we have that clip somewhere.
That's nice. That's nice. Whoa. Only if you want to win. Only if you want to win. Maybe you don't want to win. Maybe you don't want to win. Thank you, D-Roy. Thank you. No, only do that if you want to win. If you want to lose, don't do that. Keep getting your 3% every 4 years.
He somehow gets invited there and goes in there and says, you don't have to vote for me. I think it would be good for you to do it. You can just sit here and keep getting your 2 to 3% because you're never going to win any other way. That's hilarious. That's boldness. And then you, again, we've talked about the contrast. The contrast of Donald Trump in the Bronx. Donald Trump going to the Chick-fil-A. Donald Trump going to the bodega in Uptown Manhattan, in Harlem. And then Joe Biden with the circles. Joe Biden going to that random gas station in Pennsylvania and crabbing about wanting an ice cream cone. Donald Trump goes to Chick-fil-A and buys everybody milkshakes. Joe Biden just wanders around at the gas station wondering where he can get his own ice cream cone. The contrasts. This was Joe Biden was speaking at a commencement address for West Point. These are the troops. And notice how this was one of the highlights or the lowlights of his speech there. This is clip 2. Oh, I'm sorry. Play clip 3.
America is the strongest when we lead not only by our example of our power, but by the power of our example. You can clap for that.
Miranda, let's peel apart that statement there. I mean, what are your thoughts when you hear him say that?
Well, my first thought is that he had to ask the audience to clap him. That's pretty sad. That's shades of Jeb Bush. And the applause was pretty minimal, so it didn't sound like it was a very receptive audience. He's said that line, he says over and over, and it's not his original line. He lifted that from Bill Clinton when he was introducing Barack Obama back in 2008. So as usual, Joe Biden is lifting other people's words. It's sort of hollow, I think, when it comes from a man who isn't leading the world very well.
Just low energy, isn't leading the world very well. We were talking about it before the show, Jesse and I, about he plagiarizes everything. I mean, Divine comments there how he took that line from Bill Clinton, never credits him, and then he takes the line from Jeb Bush. You can clap for that. It's just the lowest energy you've ever seen, and he's not out campaigning. Can you imagine if the Democrats would campaign him in front of the Libertarian National Convention, or if they would take him to an audience in a red state, if they would take him to Oklahoma City. But Donald Trump is in the Bronx. He's taking their voters away. There's one more. I mean, talk about a snooze fest. This was from a press conference that Joe Biden had with the leader of Kenya last week, clip 9.
And spur innovation, it extends from Silicon Valley in California to Silicon Savannah in Kenya, which, by the way, is already a $1 billion tech hub. Already a billion-dollar tech hub. You know, the African continent's got up a billion people not too soon. The idea we're going to ignore it makes no sense at all. First question, Michael Wilner, McClatchy.
Thank you, Mr. President. Two questions, if I may, on...
No, one.
I'm going to do my level best on or to contain them, and on Israel. Does the United
One
States...
One question. I'll answer your question.
Okay.
The question with regard to Haiti is... Okay, next. Do I ask the next question as well? And by the way, you asked about... You implied that we weren't doing anything anywhere else. Well, we're kind of occupied around the world, but we're also engaged in Congo, in the neighborhood. And next question from April Ryan. What was my question?
sir, your question was Haiti. Can the United States and Kenya or the nations collectively break the backs of this coordinated militia that has the grips of the nation? That nation. Thank you.
Yes. The very way we're doing it.
Of the matters in DRC.
Let me ask Nancy Agutu from Kenya.
And to tackle climate change, what is your commitment on this? Thank you.
Would you? I'm sorry, I didn't catch all your question. So people can grow. That's what it's about.
Will you allow Ukraine to strike inside Russia?
Whoa!
This concludes the press conference. Thanks, everybody.
What a contrast. Remember how fun a Trump press conference was to watch? And then he hardly does them, and that's how it is. That was a bit longer than I remember that clip being, and I'm kind of getting tired now. Anyway, I'm running out of time. I wanted to play a Key of David program for you about, it touches on some themes of Memorial Day. And just as I was talking about earlier, Mr. Fleury mentions how, you know, America, we're not ready to fight for freedom like we used to. We're not ready to fight to uphold the rule of law. And he talks about really the things that made America great. This is an article, I think excerpts of this are from the booklet, No Freedom Without Law. This article is titled, A Lesson to Remember by Mr. Gerald Fleury. He says, today Americans pause to reflect on the achievements and sacrifices made by our millions of soldiers, past and present. Their courage and selflessness has done much to uphold the greatness of this nation. Many people connect the freedoms we enjoy with their willingness to fight. But did you realize that a far more noble achievement, and one we are in danger of losing today, was how those sacrifices helped establish America's rule of law? And then he talks about that in this Key of David program, this program that I want to play for you. It's titled Abandon the Constitution, and it was given in March of 2013. And again, we'll just conclude the show with that. Again, it's titled Abandon the Constitution. And he talks about the themes of that article and some themes that touch on Memorial Day. Well, we'll transition right into that. Thank you for joining us on today's show. If you have any comments for us, you can email those td@thetrumpet.com.
Greetings, everyone. Both political parties in the U.S. will have some people who dislike or perhaps hate the Constitution, but it seems like today most of those people come from what we call the radical left and don't have a good opinion of the Constitution of the United States at all. Now, is there a problem with that, and what does it all mean? If people hate the Constitution and want to do away with it, is that a big problem, or is it nation-destroying, as many people believe? What is it going to produce? The Constitution itself says that it is the supreme law of the land. The supreme law of the land. Now, if you do away with the supreme law of the land, as some are saying we should do, well, what is that going to bring? Is it going to bring anarchy and chaos? And is it really dangerous to this entire land and to everybody who lives here in America? If you look at the Old Testament and our forefathers in the book of Joshua and Judges, it's all really one book, and it says there at the very end that every man did that which was right in his own eyes. He didn't have a law to look to, and everybody just made up their mind how they were going to live and what they were going to do, and just after that, Israel was conquered. So what kind of leadership can you possibly have if you don't have some law and somebody there to implement the law? Now, Abraham Lincoln believed strongly in the Constitution and fought a civil war to preserve that Constitution and lost We lost thousands and thousands of lives. It was all about the Constitution. And Mr. Lincoln talked about that often. Now, he said he knew there were bad laws, but you go ahead and you keep the Constitution just the way it is until you can, by the Constitution, change those bad laws. But do it constitutionally, he said. And that's what he did, and many people have called him the greatest president that we have. So we do have quite a history there that we need to look to. But this is your country, and this is, as we make changes like that, it's going to influence and have everything to do with your life. And the stakes are awfully high. If you look at the supreme law of the land, and if it's taken away, well, what is going to replace it? What is there that's going to replace it? I personally believe the Constitution of the United States is one of the most noble documents on this earth ever created by man. And I'll show you a little more about why I believe that as we go along here, but it is popular these days to be challenging the Constitution and saying we should get rid of it. This is a long New York Times article, December the 20th, 2012. The title of the article is "Let's Give Up on the Constitution" by Lewis Michael Seidman. And here is how he opens the article: "As the nation teeters at the edge of fiscal chaos, observers are reaching the conclusion that the American system of government is broken. But almost no one blames the culprit, our insistence on obedience to the Constitution, with all the archaic, idiosyncratic, and downright evil provisions." Now, what does the Constitution really have to do with the fiscal chaos? I mean, that's a weakness of character in men, not in a document or not in a law, because they're not following financial laws. But that's what he says. He goes on to say, "As someone who has taught constitutional law for almost 40 years, I am ashamed it took me so long to see how bizarre all this is." Now, there obviously is evil in any age, and Abraham Lincoln had to use, really, the Constitution to destroy slavery and that terrible evil. But he did it according to the Constitution. Other people had twisted the Constitution to their own way of thinking, but Abraham Lincoln brought us back into the supreme law of the land, where this law applies to every man, to the Gentile, the Israelite, every man. And that is the way the Constitution reads if you're an American citizen. This professor was also on CBS News, and he was asked, "Is the U.S. Constitution truly worthy of the reverence in which most Americans hold it?" A view on that from Lewis Michael Seidman, professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University. Well, he said, "I've got a simple idea. Let's give up on the Constitution." And he goes on to say, he's not talking about every part of it, but once you start doing away with, let's say, a large segment of it, the way he's talking about it, leads to the destruction of the whole document. That's just the way things tend to go. And everything tends toward lawlessness if you look at human nature as it is without anybody trying to control it. But he talked about it. We should not be keeping it because of a bunch of people who are now long dead favored them 2 centuries ago. But then on the other hand, if you look at the Ten Commandments of the Bible, many people still believe in that document, which was given to us around 6,000 years ago. So it's still a very good document because it was established by God and by the people who loved God and knew God and knew the Bible as it was at that time. This article goes on to say, "This is our country. This is just a CBS News report. This is our country. We live in it, he says, and we have a right to the kind of country we want. We would not allow the French or the United Nations to rule us, and neither should we allow people who died over two centuries ago and knew nothing of our country as it exists today. Well, now, there's a wrong focus here, I believe, and I think you could see that as well. If we are to take back our country, he says, we have to start making decisions for ourselves and stop deferring to an ancient and outdated document. Now, one of the Supreme Court justices agrees with that. Is it right or is it wrong? Or is it nation-destroying, as some people say? Will it destroy the Republic of America? What's wrong with that reasoning, if there's anything wrong with it? Or what is the flaw in that reasoning? We can't very well sit on the sidelines when you're talking about the supreme law of the land. We can't just sit here and do nothing. Everybody needs to be concerned. But I'll tell you one thing that our forefathers understood a lot better than we do today. They understood the Bible a lot better. They understood God a lot better. They understood the rule of law a lot better. And they understood human nature far better than we do today. Far better. And I can show you a little of that today, and we'll give you literature to absolutely prove it to you, that that is a fact. Now, our forefathers were, in a sense, when they came from Britain, as far as their religious freedom concerned especially, were living in a kind of slavery themselves. They couldn't worship the way they wanted to. They couldn't speak out the way they wanted to and felt that they had the right to do. And so they came to this country and they wanted to establish a constitutional document that would give them freedom from tyranny, freedom from human nature running rampant. Now, let me just read something to you here in a moment. But if you, again, think about the prophets and apostles of the Bible, they look at all that they established that we still follow today, because it is something that they look to God to get. And the Constitution is the same to some degree, to a large degree, as a matter of fact. But these apostles and prophets knew God. They knew the Ten Commandments. But you see, this Constitution is not easy to hold on to. And even the forefathers knew that people would come along and challenge the document. Benjamin Franklin said, "We've given you a republic if you can keep it." But are you willing? Do we have lots of people that are willing to fight and die even for the Constitution the way they did in the beginning to establish it? And they spilled their blood to establish this document because they so wanted freedom from tyranny and freedom from human nature that would like to believe they know how to rule. Human nature believes it knows how to rule everything. And it, in fact, knows how to rule nothing. If you look at God's Word, that is what it says. This Seidman wrote the book on constitutional disobedience, and he asked, well, why should we care about what the Constitution says? Why should we even care about it? Well, why should we even care about any law? How about any financial law? Let's just go and spend like everything you have into the over $16 trillion of debt. The problem is not a document. The problem is not keeping laws. That's about not keeping financial laws. 2 + 2 = 4. And yet, we want to blame a document for that. Instead of ourselves, instead of our own human nature, which we all have and need to overcome. That's the whole plan of the Bible. But that is America's foundational document. It is the foundation of our republic. What are we going to do when it's gone? I'm going to show you how deadly dangerous that thinking is. And this is not a political statement, because you have people coming from both sides that are very critical of the Constitution. But if you have to be careful, or there'll be rulers that will take away your religious freedom, your freedom of speech, and all the other freedoms that we enjoy. The New York Times wrote in April 2012, increasingly in recent months, the administration has been seeking ways to act without Congress. Or they might add, without the Constitution, because you're not supposed to act without Congress. They have everything to do with enforcing that document. It's not just for the executive branch. It's for the legislature and the judicial branch. They all work together to give us success in our nation and real rule that is fair to everyone. And that is what the Constitution teaches. Notice what the famous British historian Paul Johnson wrote. Quote, this was December 26, 1999 in the Sunday Telegraph. And he said, the rule of law, as distinct from the rule of a person or a class of people, in other words, do you want the rule of a law or the rule of a person or a group of people? You better think about that, because I'll tell you this, the Bible says that you should live according to a document, and so does the Constitution. And it has been oh so successful for some 200 years. But anyhow, it talks about, or you could be ruled by a class of people, he says, or as opposed to the rule of force, is an abstract, sophisticated concept. It is mighty difficult to achieve. But until it is achieved and established in the public mind with such vehemence that masses of individuals are prepared to die to uphold it, just as our forefathers were willing to die to establish it. I mean, you have to really believe in something to do that. Do our people today believe in the Constitution to that degree? Oh, it seems to me we're falling short there. It does indeed. He goes on to say, no other form of progress can be regarded as secure. The Greeks had tried to establish the rule of law but failed. The Romans had succeeded under the Republic, but Caesar and his successors had destroyed it. The essence of the rule of law is impersonality, omnipotence, and ubiquity. It is the same law for everyone, every person. Well, you see, that's where if you're going to have some kind of slavery, if that's not the way it is, you're going to have some kind of slavery for everyone that is denied that. He concludes, everywhere, kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself are subject to it. If exceptions are made, the rule of law begins to collapse. That was the grand lesson of antiquity. That was it. The grand lesson was right there. And we have to learn from history. You better look back at history and see how many people tried to establish the rule of law and could not do it or could not sustain it. They couldn't maintain it. And today, I'll tell you, we're in, a lot of confusion. And really, I'll say to you that that's our only security is establishing and maintaining that document. If we lose that, you're going to see anarchy and chaos and violence like you've never seen in this country. What's to stop it? There's no law to stop it. There might be tyranny to stop some of it, but is that going to enslave you? Would you be willing to die for a lot of confusion? You see, Mr. Johnson said this, both in Virginia and New England, to the north, the colonists were determined, God-fearing men. Mr. Johnson wrote, often in search of a religious toleration denied them at home. They were slaves in a sense. In that sense, who brought their families and were anxious to farm and establish permanent settlements, they put political and religious freedom before riches. Thus took shape the economic dynamo that eventually became the United States, an experiment designed to establish the rule of God on earth. What's that? The rule of God on earth? These are the people that created the Constitution. They really wanted, many of them wanted to establish the rule of God on this earth. And they wrote this Constitution, and a lot of it is based on the Bible and Ten Commandments. And so those people who want to destroy the Constitution also, well, they don't have a high opinion of the Bible either, and they don't like God telling them what to do, if they even believe in God. So, well, where does that leave us? Does it leave us not at their mercy? Or at their mercy? Well, let me read to you what Earl Warren said when he was talking about religion and morality being the basis, really, of the Constitution, that you really do have to have a deep belief in God or you can't maintain it. But he said this in 1954, Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote, "I believe the entire Bill of Rights came into being because of the knowledge our forefathers had of the Bible and their belief in it." You see, that's where our forefathers were much superior than we are today. We talk about the Bible, but how much do we believe in it? They believed in it. Now, they didn't every single one believe in it, but overall they did. Now, the politicians today, well, I don't think they measure up nearly like the politicians anciently or our forefathers. Those men who were politicians had more faith in the Bible than our religious people do today, for the most part. That is the truth. We wrote in our booklet on the Freedom Without Law, "The Constitution is the foundation of our republic, and the Ten Commandments were in many ways the foundation of the Constitution." Now, again, it was just in principle in most cases, but we're talking about a spirit of working against law here and lawlessness entering into the land more and more, whether it be Canada or Britain or Australia or New Zealand or the Jewish people in the Middle East. There is too much of that spirit that is plaguing these countries. Too much of it that is causing all kinds of problems, and the rule of law is not doing well in those countries. And God has a lot to say about it in the Bible, if you know anything about Bible prophecy. But the forefathers shed their blood, streams of blood flowed because they were fighting to establish the Constitution, if you will, that document, so they could have freedom and they could keep the government off their backs and keep them away when they tried to have their way and thought they had a better idea. Those people that talk about doing away with the Constitution don't really have an idea about, well, what is going to replace it? What do you do when you take away the rule of law? What do you do when you take away the police? Do you think you might have a breakdown of society? Well, it really is the same principle. But our forefathers fought en masse and gave their lives, many of them, for the freedoms that we enjoy today. And men will sit and be very critical when they don't know much about that. They don't understand it. They think they do, but I tell you they don't. Because there's a spirit there that is deadly dangerous to you as an individual and to your country. Would you or I be willing to die for the Constitution? Well, I don't think too many would. The Constitution was based to a great extent on God's law. That is a fact. So if the Constitution, the Supreme Court justices, for example, they're just chosen for life. They're subject not to anybody except the Constitution. It's just the Constitution itself that they're subject to. They're supposed to obey that document, and if they get to the point where they begin to change it because they think it ought to be changed and not doing it constitutionally, they're just acting like tyrants. That's all it amounts to. It's very simple. We needn't complicate this. It's really very simple. They want to rewrite the Constitution in all too many cases. And of course, as Mr. Robert Bork, who recently died, said, that the big trump card in American politics is the Constitution. Oh, everybody wants to control or change the Constitution
to the way they want it, but not necessarily go through Congress and the judicial and the executive branches to do that. They just want to change it because they think they're right. They're just so sure they're right, but they do not know often what they're talking about. Robert Bork wrote this. He said, a well-known Harvard law professor, Mr. Bork wrote, turned to me with some exasperation and said, your notion that the Constitution is in some sense law must rest upon an obscure philosophic principle with which I am unfamiliar. But look, it says this. Here, let me read you something from the Constitution. This is from the Constitution itself, and it says, it shall be the supreme law of the land. This document shall be the supreme law of the land. Now look, I'll tell you, if you don't have the if you don't have the Constitution, you're going to have, let's say, we'll just say you're going to have human nature dictating what we should do. You're going to have Satan, the devil, dictating what we should do. The God of this world, 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. That's the real problem here. But I want to just, I don't have time to get into too much of this, but we have to make a choice. But look, you can look at Jeremiah 17 and verse 9, and here's what it says. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Now, those men that want to change the Constitution, they probably don't agree with that at all. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Now, who understands human nature like that? After all, the God of this world is the devil. That's what your Bible says. And Revelation 12 and verse 9 says he deceives the whole world. Let me tell you, people think like the devil too much of the time unless they're fighting to overcome human nature. God says that your human heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. How many people believe that? And it says, goes on in verse 5 to say, you're under a curse if you follow a man. You should follow only God, never a man. That certainly includes myself. Don't follow me. That's not going to get you any place except in trouble. What you want to do is follow God. But look, if you start working your way around Congress and the judicial branch, well, then you're just eviscerating the Constitution. You're just disemboweling that document and tearing it apart. And without that supreme law, it's going to just bring violence and all kinds of evil into the social areas of our life. That's what's going to happen. But you see, God says, okay, he'll let us go and do a lot of these evil things, but he's about to come and stop this madness in this world and establish an even greater document than the Constitution of the United States. That's what we really look forward to. Until next week, this is Gerald Fleury. Goodbye, friends.